So is the United States the next Greece? You've probably heard some of the comparisons, especially the stat that our budget deficit is roughly the same percentage of the total economy as theirs is, and they're going down the financial tubes. But Princeton economics professor and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman has devoted his columns last Friday and today to trying to debunk that idea and to argue that it's an excuse by people who really want to dismantle Social Security. He joins us now to talk about that, and we'll also try to touch on the Senate passage of the bank bill last night and maybe Tuesday's election results and yesterday's mini-tanking of the stock market. Last I looked, it's down about another 50 or so. Dr. Krugman, thanks a lot for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi there. Good morning.
One idea in your column last week was that to understand why we are not Greece, we have to understand the difference between our deficit and our debt. Do you want to start on that point?
Yeah. I mean, so deficit is, in any given year, government spending more than it takes in, or in our case, it would be more accurate, I think, to say takes in less than it's spending, because the big thing has been a fall in tax revenues because of the recession. Debt is what you build up over time. The government borrows to cover that, and you end up with a debt. And we have a lot of debt. U.S. government's got a lot of debt, more than it should because of some fairly irresponsible policies during the last administration. But our debt isn't nearly as big relative to our economy as Greece's. So that's one important distinction. If you're going to have a crisis where you need to borrow money, it helps to not come in already owing a lot of money, and we sort of halfway meet that criterion.
Some people do think our debt is headed for Greek levels. If we keep on our current trajectory for the next 20 years, we'll have Nassim Taleb later in the program, who I believe thinks that. Even another Times article had that projection last week. So you can you dismiss it out of hand?
No. There's, with unchanged policies, that's where we end up with. But that's, first of all, that's 20 years. That's a long time. And it's very important to understand what's driving that. What's driving that is not some general, oh, we're irresponsible, we don't want to pay for what we get, we want to get things we can't afford. What's driving that is rising healthcare costs. If we didn't have projections that said that healthcare costs, Medicare, Medicaid, will continue to rise in the future as they have in the past, then the deficit forecast would look a whole lot more manageable. So, I mean, this is one of those things. People try to use the deficit as a kind of generic, oh, government's too big, we need to do something. When, if you actually look at the numbers, if you actually dig into them, it turns out that what we need is a more efficient healthcare system. If our healthcare costs were as low as that of actually any other advanced country, because we're far and away the most expensive, we wouldn't have a problem at all.
So if health reform actually works, then it works to mitigate that problem.
Yeah, that's right. The cost-saving measures, nobody knows how well they'll work, but the things that were in the healthcare reform that just passed are actually exactly the right thing to do. You need to start looking for ways to make the system more efficient. You need to stop paying for treatments that don't actually yield any medical gain. You need to reduce the crazy high administrative costs we have in our system because of insurance companies spending a lot of money trying to figure out who really needs coverage so as to not give it to them. And all of those things are exactly what we need to make to bring our budget situation under control. The problem is not this year's deficit. The problem is healthcare costs 10 or 15 years from now.
Another way that we're not Greece is that people in Greece are rioting in the streets over cuts to government benefits, whereas the trend in the U.S. seems to be rising popularity of deficit hawks like Rand Paul. Have you thought about why we're not Greece in our political relationship to government debt?
Well, first of all, we haven't had any real cuts. So people, you know, the Greeks are reacting to things that are about to happen. We've had this peculiar thing where you have audiences of retired people receiving their Social Security and Medicare benefits cheering the likes of Rand Paul as they say, down with government. Don't let the government get its hands on your Medicare. So we're still in a situation where people can have it both ways. And the Greeks, sadly for them, are now up against the point where they can't live on illusions anymore.
Paul Krugman, my guest on WNYC, and Joe in Spring Valley wants to argue that we're actually worse than Greece. Is that right, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, we are far worse because the only difference is we can print the dollar and we have nothing to print. And, you know, people like Paul Krugman, they're delusional. I received a letter from President Obama last week, and he's saying he's going to implement my plan to create jobs, and that is manufacturing jobs. We don't produce anything. At least Greece produces more than, you know, we do, you know, as per capita is concerned. So the whole notion that, you know, so we're dealing with $60 trillion in private debt, that's mortgages and corporate bonds and et cetera, and $600 trillion in derivatives outstanding. If one of the counterparties fails, this whole system will collapse like a house of cards. I mean, at least Greece, they're not delusional because they know that they cannot print money, and we keep on printing to cover our shorts.
Joe, thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so let me get, I mean, in a way, actually, the caller is right. The fact that the Greeks don't have their own money, that they're shackled to the euro, which is a real problem for them. They have basically their costs have gotten out of line with the rest of Europe because too much money was flooding in, and now they have no way of bringing those costs down except to take big wage cuts and suffer a very severe recession. That's actually the key reason why they're in worse shape than we are. But as for the rest, you know, our problem now is not a lack of productive ability. It's not a lack of willing workers. It's not a lack of factories and office buildings. We have factories and office buildings and workers sitting idle. We've got almost 10% of the workforce unemployed because there isn't enough demand for what they can produce. And so our problem actually is to get somebody spending more. That is, we are in a situation right now where the problem for the nation as a whole is too little spending, which is leaving lots of willing, productive workers sitting there doing nothing. And that's why we're in a situation where the normal rules don't apply, where you say, oh, well, we have to be doing something productive, and you can't just spend your way out of it. Actually, spending our way out of it is exactly what we need to do right now.
Though there's no prospect for that politically in Washington. I saw today you wrote that you would like to see a stimulus, too, and you think a lot of economists in the Obama administration would as well, but no one dare speak that name.
Right. The political sentiment is not there. There's been this really amazing dynamic where every time interest rates go up a bit on expansion of the economy, on hopes for a recovery, people in Washington start yelling, oh, it's the bond vigilantes. People are losing faith in America. Got to cut back on your spending. And then when interest rates go back down again, silence. And then when they go back up, again, there are the screams that we're in terrible trouble, and so it's a perfect perpetual motion machine. As of a couple of minutes ago, the interest rate on long-term U.S. government debt was 3.19%, which is incredibly low. People, investors, don't seem to think there's any risk at all in buying U.S. bonds, but you can be sure that when it goes back up to 3.5, we'll have all of the shouts that we're Greece all over again.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. My guest, 212-433-WNYC. And after you wrote your column last night, the Senate passed the bank reform bill that does many things, from place derivatives trades on an open exchange, to create a new consumer financial protection agency, to create a new system for dismantling big banks that get into trouble rather than bailing them out. Is this an important vote, in your opinion?
Yeah, If you wanted a real dismantling of overblown finance, then you're going to be disappointed. This bill was not the bill that a group of philosopher economists insulated from all politics would have written. But it's a lot better, actually, than I expected we were going to get. It's better than the bill the House passed, which is sort of a first in this Congress. So we hope that the negotiated bill will actually look more like the Senate bill. It's vastly stronger than what we expected the Senate to pass. I'd like to add one more thing in there. It's got ratings reform. Companies will no longer get to shop for the rating agency that gives them the best rating. That's thanks to Senator Al Franken, who's turning out to be a real important policy player. You know, it's not bad.
I actually just put up a blog post a few minutes ago saying, thank you, Lloyd Blankfein. If it weren't for the Goldman scandals, it wouldn't be as good as it is.
That's really funny. But I noticed that two of the most progressive Democrats voted against the bill, Maria Cantwell of Washington State and Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, I guess over loopholes in the derivative rules. Do you understand their objections and do you agree with them?
Yeah, they're right that there are some loopholes. And the amendments they were proposing would have made it stronger. Although I have to say that some of the finance gurus I talked to actually thought that their amendments would have been easily bypassed. But that's something where actually I find myself out of my depth. So they were right, I think, to try to hold Harry Reid's feet to the fire. I understand their position. I also understand the position that says that this is not a bad reform and you should get it passed. So it was a tough call. I mean, it really wasn't a question of whether to be against this reform. The question was whether to keep the Senate debate rolling for another week so as to try and squeeze it into being somewhat better than it is. And that was a close call.
And on this one, the party of hell no became the party of mostly no. Three Republicans did vote for the bill, Susan Collins and Olympia Snow of Maine, and interestingly, Scott Brown. Any analysis of the Scott Brown vote?
I really don't know. I mean, Scott Brown is, you know, when all is said and done, representing a pretty liberal state. And he may, I mean, it's good to see that the rigid Republican discipline of no didn't work on this case, but who knows what's going on there. I gather that he actually had promised Harry Reid a yes vote on the previous vote and then didn't deliver. And maybe he was told about rules of senatorial courtesy or something, but who knows? But no, I mean, I think this will be unique.
I thought there were no rules of senatorial courtesy anymore. But Gretchen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Paul Krugman. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Krugman, I just want to know, after we do another stimulus program, another stimulus package, how do we dispose of all this debt? I mean, we've been basically having this very loose monetary policy now for so many years and practicing all this fiscal, I mean, I would say it's not irresponsible, but we're ballooning our debt. What are we going to do about this once the crisis is over?
Yeah, so economic recovery will get us part of the way, but only part of the way. I mean, tax receipts are way down, and they'll come back up when the economy gets back to something close to full employment. That won't be enough. You basically look at it, and looking out towards five or 7 years from now, we will have a budget that is we'll have a budget deficit. That by itself is not necessarily a problem because we've got a growing economy, so as long as the debt grows more slowly than the economy, we're okay. But we won't actually even be at that point. So a budget deficit that is like 3 or 4 percentage points of GDP too big. So you have to find 3 or 4 percentage points of GDP someplace. To find some of it by cutting wasteful spending, of which the biggest is actually in the military. We can save probably about 1% of GDP by not still having a military that's ready to repel Soviet tanks when they sweep across Germany. But the rest is going to have to come from, I think, probably going to need some additional taxes, probably in the end going to have a value-added tax that gives us a couple of points of GDP. And none of this works unless you also have health reform that really effective cost controls of the kind that we have a start on in the health reform bill that was passed earlier this year, but it's only a start. So if you look at historically, if you look at the kinds of adjustments that other countries have made, and not just heroic or spectacular crisis adjustments, but just things that countries that have done in the past, whether it's Belgium in the 90s, which used to have a very big budget problem, or Canada in the 80s. If you look at these things, you see that we have something that is the kind of thing that advanced democracies have managed to do without too much trouble. I guess the big question is whether our political system is just so polarized, whether we have so many crazy people being elected to Congress that we can't do the things that, from an economic point of view, shouldn't be that hard to do.
Any quick take on, and Gretchen, thank you for your call, Paul Krugman, my guest, for another few minutes. Any quick take on the stock market's almost 400-point plunge yesterday? I happened to be watching CNBC during the last hour of the trading, and they were breathless about the passage of the Senate bill causing the smart money to get out of the markets and into cash. But the Times front page today says the Senate deal actually rescued the Dow from being even worse because the uncertainty is ending over financial regulation. Do you have an opinion?
You know, there was a great Robert Shiller at Yale did a great study during the 1987 stock market crash. And after that one, there were all kinds of explanations about why the stock market crashed. But he actually was set up. He was able to do a survey while it was crashing to ask people, why are you selling stocks? And none of the explanations that people mentioned actually showed up in any of his correspondence. All of the everything he got was that I'm selling stocks because prices are going down. So I think this attempt to find a reason for the big fall is basically, you know, people are projecting onto it. There was some bad economic news yesterday morning. The unemployment claims were higher than we wanted to see. There are still rumbles from troubles in Europe, but we had a 1,000-point decline not long ago, and we still have no idea what that was about.
We've been getting different opinions on the show from various guests over the last few weeks about the local take on health reform, the fear that Mayor Bloomberg and banking reform, the fear that Mayor Bloomberg and others have that cracking down on derivatives trading and proprietary trading here will make Wall Street jobs flee from New York to Europe. And there are mixed opinions on this. What's yours?
I think the Europeans are going to be following our lead, so I don't worry about the international competition. I do think that there is an issue that our financial sector is almost certainly overblown, and one of the goals of reform is actually to shrink it, to reduce the number of people earning enormous amounts of money for pushing other people's money around in not very productive ways. So, and that's bad for New York, because unfortunately New York has increasingly specialized in doing that, if you like. And in effect, New York City has become an economy that whose almost sole export industry is doing dubious things with other people's money. And so shrinking that is going to hurt New York for a while. There's no way around that. And I'm a bit of a New York patriot, so I'm unhappy to see that, but not unhappy enough to think that we don't need to do the financial reform.
The other side of that, though, and we just have less than a minute left, but German Chancellor Angela Merkel this week unilaterally imposed controls on naked short sellers and other financial speculation in Germany. A, do you like that? And B, maybe that'll make European investors or market makers flee to here.
I don't think that that's a particularly wise move, and I think to some extent Merkel is just lashing out. I'm in favor of cracking down on finance, but you want to do it in a way that you've really thought about what it is you're doing, not just as a kind of knee-jerk reaction, which is what I think happened there.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman arguing in today's column as well as last Friday's column that the U.S. is not Greece, that we have a clear pathway to recovery that they don't have. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.